Hi everyone, and welcome to Fraser's Capital Podcast. In this episode, I have a chat with Etty Amager, Director at Access Partners, where he's raised money for some of the highest returning and most respected hedge funds in the world. In this episode, we go deep into recent market volatility, the market outlook, and we discuss how to stay on top of innovation and disruption. I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. Hi Etty, how's it going?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. What's going on?
Not much. Thanks for coming back on the podcast.
No, thank you. It's an honor. It's been a while since the last time I was on here. I've been listening to the last few podcasts, and actually not few, I mean all of them, and they've been really, really good. So I'm actually glad I'm here again to give everyone a bit of an update on what's been happening in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting week, last week.
Yeah, that's right. I remember the last time we spoke, we talked about volatility and it's back.
Yeah, it really is.
So, I mean, what have you been seeing in space?
Well, I feel like this week was a bit of a change. I mean, it's basically markets have been rallying since the beginning of the year, actually since kind of the last few days of December. This is the first week you actually saw some pretty big moves, including some pretty big intraday moves. So a couple of times markets dipped, you know, 1.5% and ended up 50 basis points, 0.5%. So it's kind of 2% intraday moves we just haven't seen in quite a while. One of the reasons it's interesting is a lot of funds obviously have to reduce exposure once you start seeing those moves. So it's a big question is whether the volatility last week, was that enough to start triggering, you know, indiscriminate selling by vol targeting funds, or was it just, you know, not quite enough and we just go back to how things were?
And how have you played that though?
Well, I've kind of been lucky in the sense that we caught the rally. So we had a very good kind of start to the year. So as that rally continued and got kind of longer in the tooth, we were able to build up our short positions and like structurally flawed, you know, industries and sectors. So broadly the way our portfolio is structured now is where about 90% invested, you know, innovative companies, companies growing really fast, companies with huge amounts of operational momentum, you know, in online retail, in payments, as well as companies going through transformations. These are really exciting investment opportunities on the long side. But in pretty much every case, we've been able to identify, you know, kind of balancing, effectively hedge. So in like, for example, for Amazon, which is growing fast and taking market share off physical retailers, we found a retail ETF, which we can slowly sell into.
Right.
And so that position was actually really small. The short position was like much smaller than our long. But as the markets have risen, we've been able to build that position up. It's been quite substantial.
So essentially, I mean, right now your fund is acting like a hedged equities portfolio.
At the moment, we're completely flat.
Right.
I mean, ultimately, you know, because some of our stocks have gone up so well, they've become larger positions. So we'll probably still be more volatile on the long side than a typical index. But at the same time, we are completely hedged. So
and your fund, obviously you have a big exposure to more of your tech, your highly innovative companies, and a bit of biotech I think you have in there, correct?
Yeah.
So when volatility does hit, do you feel that a lot?
You definitely feel it. I mean, we will generally make more than the market and often we'll have higher volatility as well.
Right.
But that just comes from having, you know, 20 high conviction stocks. And I really think that's like kind of how we position ourselves. I mean, if we see an incredible investment opportunity, we want to take a position that's meaningful for all our clients because effectively we hold the assets on trust. So when we take a 5% position, it's like all our clients did. And they don't come around too often. There's not that many amazing opportunities that are exciting that you can really talk about. You know, talking about companies growing at over 100% organically that have sold off 50%, you know, that might happen once every year or once every 2 years. You see something that's that good. And I guess the perfect company for us is something that is just operating fantastically and every quarter, you know, updates on how well they're doing. So an example of that is Afterpay. I mean, we bought that in 2017.
Yeah, what a story that is.
Their numbers are insane. I mean, it's, you know, it's the amount of repeat customers they get, how low their cost of customer acquisition cost is. You know, the lifetime value of each customer is immense. And at the same time, they're just picking up millions of customers. So they've got 3.5 million customers now. Their loss rates have gone down. You know, pretty much every number is pointing in the right direction, and they're just at the beginning of kind of their story.
And they're, and so they've just actually entered the US market. How do you think that's going to go there?
We kind of know. So there should be over 1 million customers there now.
Right.
And basically the way they work is obviously that customer base improves. So every week that passes, a few people default and they just get weeded out of the pool. And so their existing customer base kind of improves in quality with every passing day. But it's been taken up. I guess there were two questions with Afterpay. It was, would they be hit by Australian regulation?
And they survived that.
Yeah. And the question was, would it work overseas? And it's kind of decisively answered that it will work overseas. And they've got pretty good expansion strategy. So basically they have stores in Australia that have operations in the US. So they can go to that US store and say, look, we've made, look at what we've done for you online in Australia. We got incremental demand of 25%. It's a very compelling argument. And now they're actually opening the UK. So that's the new thing they're doing.
Yeah, I saw they've just, they got ASOS on board, actually, and which is a huge brand for them to get on board.
And the UK is, I've never really spent too much time in the US, obviously visit it. But I spent about 8 years in the UK, and I feel like a cost, you know, I feel like there's a lot of cost-sensitive people there, and I feel like this is a product that will go very well in that market.
Look, well, the UK, we all know, it's a value market. Look at all the managers, all the great managers out there. They're all value guys.
It's also like there's two Englands, right? There's London, and then there's like the rest of England, and they're in many ways completely different places.
Yeah.
You know, completely different demographics, and I can imagine Afterpay doing quite well there. But again, to expand there, they can just basically take case studies from the success they had in the US and bring it to the UK. And interestingly, there's a lot of competition coming up, but none of them have done what Afterpay is doing. Like, their products are different. They're all offering lines of credit. It's amazing that nobody's tried to actually just straight out copy them. And I guess the closest one is, you know, maybe QuadPay, like the literal clones.
So, okay, because Afterpay has had a massive run. Over the short term, and I'm sure it's, I don't know what the actual percentage it is in your portfolio now, but I'm sure it's run up a lot. How are you playing that stock? I mean, are you hedging it here? Have you paired it, or what are you doing there?
I think there's two things. So we can talk about the value of Afterpay, and then also how we approach, you know, what happens when our stocks increase significantly.
Yeah.
And you know, the mistakes we've made and the kind of wins we've had as well, the good and bad. So basically, in terms of value, Afterpay, you can actually value it normally. You know, people think it's like a kind of momentum stock. And I think mistakes a lot of growth investors do is they look at the top line revenue growth and assume many of these companies are basically the same, but they're not. So in Afterpay, you've got, you know, the number of customers they've got. You can, how much they transact every year, like the times they transact every year and the value of each transaction. You can then pull that out with the amount they charge for transaction and come up with a revenue number. They then got about 4 or 5 cost items, you know, cost of financing, you know, bad debts. They also got, you know, kind of a positive cost recovery line item. So you can go from there to kind of effectively like a gross profit. From there, you can just basically add some costs, what you think it'll cost them to run the business. Again, you can kind of extrapolate from, you know, the amount they're spending here and the amount that it'll cost them for every unit of revenue elsewhere. And to do that, you can basically forecast, you know, a range of revenue and profit numbers under different scenarios. Like if they reach, you know, 3 million customers, what is that worth if they're transacting this amount this many times? So I modeled this out, you know, almost 2 years, well, more than about 2 years ago now. And every like few months, I need to come back and lift all these numbers in my model.
Yeah.
You know, like I faded this thing down. It's amazing how like fast it's grown. So if you extrapolate the amount of customers they're gaining kind of month by month now, 2 years ahead, you'd be amazed at how cheap this company is. The way we'll do it is we'll have a range of kind of values under different scenarios. And it's just, you know, when we value something, we break down the stock performance into its fundamental performance, then the market component. You know, what is the market valuing those fundamentals? So the market stuff you can never really predict. That's kind of like the unknown variable.
Yeah.
But I can see on the fundamental side, they're just way ahead of where we thought they would be.
Okay.
So at the moment, in many ways, the investment is as compelling as it's ever been, if not more compelling, because now we know they will survive regulation in Australia. And they're taking off in the US. Like, they're the two big questions.
So are you going to let it run, or are you going to?
Well, you know, I've had Bezzy run two portfolios, long only and, you know, my fund.
Sure. Yeah.
Long only has done substantially better than the fund. One of the reasons is that is because we let these things run. Now, there's kind of there's a few different things you need to think about. I think if you actually want to maximize returns, you have to let these positions run, because I guess, you can look at it mathematically, right? Let's say I value after pay and I've got my range of outcomes, my range of fundamental outcomes and my range of market outcomes. Let's say it does very well fundamentally and it gets a very high valuation on those fundamentals. If my strategy is to trim it, then I should be discounting all those positive outcomes by the amount I'm going to trim, or I shouldn't be taking that risk. You know, so nobody really puts that in their models. Nobody says, okay, if this stock doubles, then I'm actually not going to get 100%. I'm only going to get 50 because I was selling it all the way up. You know, if you're going to do that, you need to incorporate that into your kind of valuation process. So in general, I think going forward, when we see these opportunities, we're going to take them and we're going to hold them, because that's what we're doing. We're buying them at a very good valuation based on, you know, a 2 to 5 year outcome. So once they start kicking goals, you know, that's good. You know, we're going to get paid for that, because we're taking, once we took that initial risk, we want the top outcome. You know, you can really hurt your returns by chopping off all your best positions.
Yeah, no, that is true. So to play the whole Afterpay story, would you be using a retail ETF to short it, or to hedge it? How would you play that side of things?
Well, on the short side, basically, the market is very, very hot in Australia right now.
Yeah.
I mean, tech companies around the world are trying to list here, from Israel, from the States. I mean, these companies are getting huge multiples.
Yeah, big time.
Some of them are amazing and some of them are not. You know, some of them you look at something like A2 Milk, the amount of money that company has made.
Yeah.
The amount of cash sitting on their balance sheet. Like, that company was tiny and now it's enormous.
Cinderella story that was.
And so everyone's talking about valuation. Well, they achieved well in excess of what anybody, you know, predicted. So that's a case where, you know, it's a high quality company.
Yep.
There's other companies that I won't necessarily mention names because people get so angry about it. You know, you're talking about companies with 30 to 40% organic growth, you know, 30 to 40% growth, and most of that's by acquisition. And so they've got a huge amount of integration issues to deal with. And their multiple is, you know, at 100x or higher on earnings, or even on sales. Well, not on sales, but, you know, extremely, extremely high valuations. So that's a materially different story to something like Afterpay. So Afterpay's got amazing organic growth, incredible unit economics. There's plenty of companies that are being rallying more or less in line with Afterpay without those fundamentals. So we're short a couple of those names. In smaller size. But it does mean if there's a proper dust up in Australia, which sooner or later will come, we will be able to take money off that side and then keep the long-term story intact. So George Soros always made the point that after his fund had gone up, you know, a lot, typically it would become more volatile. And he's obviously a guy that had very high returns, so he wouldn't just trim his winners. you know, just because they were going up, he'd let them run. But you think about it like kind of academically. If you have 20 stocks and they're 5% each, you know, a year later, some are going to have done very well, and the ones who haven't performed well will be much smaller. That's kind of what you want from a returns perspective and also logic. Like you don't want to be in the good ones that are kicking goals and, you know, have smaller positions in the ones that, you know, haven't performed to expectations. But if you look at that portfolio again, the big ones might be 10, 15, 20% of the size. So you've actually got a more concentrated portfolio, and that means it's more volatile.
Yeah.
So we're kind of in that situation as well, because we've had two or three stocks have done extremely well, and we haven't wanted to really trim them too much. And what that means is that, you know, the daily movement of the fund depends more on two or three things.
Yeah.
So an example of that is Carvana. So obviously that thing doubled in short order. And we didn't, you know, if we bought it because we thought it was worth 5 to 10 times as much in 4 to 5 years. So to sell it after it's kind of achieved a quarter of that or 20% of that doesn't really make any sense. You know, you might win the battle but lose the war. Mm-hmm. And we very much prefer to lose every battle and win the war.
Yeah. And historically, from what I've seen in a few other fund managers, long only, long short, is some of their biggest, faults or losses, so to speak, happens because they've trimmed stocks which have gone on a good run too early, and instead of letting them run. So, I mean, is that sort of what your theology is here, or?
I mean, it is. I mean, Afterpay became our biggest position, but if we didn't trim that at all, it would have added 10% to our fund last year.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, that is, if you think about, we made plenty of mistakes last year. For example, you know, being heavily invested in Asian tech supply chains before the trade war. All the mistakes we made, none of them had any impact as to making a decision to trim Afterpay the first time it went from, you know, $4 to $8. And broadly, I think that's a very important lesson. And it comes down to, are you an investor or are you a portfolio manager that's really carefully managing, you know, against an index? And I think the good investors, certainly the ones that make lots of money, they have to buy and they hold. You know, you have to get a 10-year outcome. You know, some of these companies could succeed for 10 years and they'll end up in places that you can't even imagine now. And you think about all the major tech companies, like almost none of them were around 15 years ago.
Hmm.
You know, and they've created hundreds of billions of dollars of value almost each. If you want to get those outcomes, you have to hold it.
For the long term, yeah.
Yeah, and most people would say that. And most people want that. The problem is, I guess, in liquid markets, you can actually adjust it on a day-to-day basis. So every time there's a tweet or, like, you know, markets sell off or look shaky, you know, every few weeks there's some reason to be worried or some headline. You cannot just sell these long-term stories based on those.
Mm.
So going forward, we're definitely going to stick to our high conviction, you know, positions.
Mm. And the thematic right now in the world, I mean, the flavor is that whole innovation, tech, mainly within software. However, obviously, you have invested in Carvana, which is more what?
That is a tech company, actually, yeah. I'd say. Because they're basically, instead of having a dealership, it's all being done online and through apps.
Okay.
Good example. I was having a conversation the other day. Somebody said, I was like, oh, actually, the growth rates are really high in my portfolio at the moment. He goes, well, how long can that last? If you're talking about trends, you know, the move to online retail, you know, these things can last a very, very long time. You know, the new people who are taking advantage of new business models from new technology, that's going to keep happening throughout our lifetimes. Similarly, people who have high fixed costs, fixed assets that are stuck, you know, the investments that were made sometimes many in a totally different world long time ago, those things can be structurally flawed for a long time.
Mm.
So you wouldn't be surprised, or we're certainly positioning for the fact that these new, fast, innovative companies will continue to grow.
Mm. But I guess when you're playing within that space, right, in the innovation space, how do you position portfolios for that? right? You can model a business for 5 years, 10 years and do all the best numbers in your world, and then disruption hits, and it can hit, especially in the area of software and tech innovation.
Well, I think you just need to really know the sector and company and only invest when you have some kind of insight. For example, a multi-year theme of ours has been to back the rise of the Chinese consumer. So in a nutshell, the idea is that there are twin effects of, or multiple effects. You know, you've got the Chinese consumer going from 300 million to 600 million by 2025, at the same time becoming much wealthier. And again, at the same time, you know, coinciding this rapid shift to online e-commerce. So we had a very fruitful investment in Alibaba, which we held from about $76 to $180, with admittedly plenty of volatility along the way. But let's say there's X billion dollars of growth in e-commerce each year. A new firm, only 4 years old, is currently taking home over 20% of that growth. It's called Pinduoduo. Now, if something is growing fast and you're taking 20% of that growth, sooner or later you become 20% of the whole. So we think this firm has a real shot of getting to 20 to 25% of the market. And it trades at a fraction of, you know, the valuation of Alibaba, say 1/20th. Whereas the business model, which is basically advertising, should have the same, you know, high margin economics. So, you know, Alibaba is often compared to Amazon. You know, Amazon makes its money, like, makes, you know, 1% to 2% on e-commerce in the US and actually loses money internationally. Whereas Alibaba's gross margins are 45% because they don't actually ship anything. It's just an advertising platform. It doesn't cost them anything to put an extra ad up. So it's really those advertising business models that are the best. And a side effect that actually makes, it's actually like an avenue where Amazon could be vastly more valuable than it is now, is if they actually switch that on properly, the advertising revenue metric. So to bring it back, so you can actually see we were originally invested in the innovator, but there was a new disruptor that actually we think offers a far better investment opportunity. You know, I mean, Pinduoduo grew so fast, literally from zero to, you know, a major Alibaba competitor in 4 years, basically off the WeChat network. So if you buy something in a group, basically if you want to buy something, you send it out to all your WeChat friends and you all get it cheaper. So you're incentivized to broadcast, you know, your purchases to everyone you know, and then so are they. So you have this really powerful viral mechanism. And this was backed by Tencent. You know, they're a shareholder. They fostered Pinduoduo on their network. And this will probably become Tencent's competitive angle against Alibaba in e-commerce. So we think they'll continue to provide a bunch of support. So it's an example of you know, just staying on top of your sector and your industry, and you can actually see the disruption as it's happening. And most of these things play out over many years. You know, just think how many times you could have invested in Google. I would imagine if a new competitor comes up against Google, there will be a lot of chatter about it. You'll hear about it. You'll know about it for many, many years. You'll probably have to pay up quite a rich valuation to invest in it. But if they can maintain that competition for like 5 to 10 years, it'll be an outstanding investment opportunity, I'm sure. So that's broadly how we look at that. Does that answer your question?
The reason I ask, look, I've seen strategies out there who invest in innovators, so to speak, but then I've also actually seen strategies who invest in disruption. So they segregate disruption and innovative companies because they believe that these innovative companies still have a chance of being disrupted by other businesses.
By somebody else.
By someone else. And I'm sort of just, you know, I'm not a PM. I'm just getting a mindset or an understanding on how someone who invests within that innovation space or innovative company space can position themselves for a disruptor.
Yeah, I think you need to look at these things case by case.
Okay.
I need to see, you know, I guess, you know, what how would that play out in our portfolio? Would there be another person that, say, you know, does a better job of doing online than Carvana? So we spent a bit of time in the looking at all the different competitors. They almost all got existing, you know, dealership infrastructure. So they're trying to do something similar to Carvana in what they think is a better model, but really they're just trying to get more traffic into their stores so their dealer owners can get their commission. You know, they've got that, like, that structural base. It's that, like, kind of innovator's dilemma thing where because they're not starting from zero, they're starting from an existing asset base. They're trying to use that. We think that there's very good reasons that they're not going to be able to actually disrupt them. You know, we're looking at this all the time.
So yeah.
if we see a company that's come up with a new business model, you know, we're going to be looking at that. We're going to be seeing that. And that's the thing we'll be investing in.
Okay.
And so I guess that's actually one of the reasons why market indices do so well. you know, everyone always thinks that like so many managers underperform, they're bad. In a weird way, it's kind of like the indices are actually just really good.
Yeah.
So you say like, let's say, look at Facebook and Google. They came out of nowhere to capture all the advertising market. They just ripped it out of, you know, all traditional media. And again, that's probably an example of a very long-term trend that you could have invested in quite a long time ago and still done extremely well.
If you foresaw that.
But you could see it, right? It's not a secret. It's like every year their revenues were growing at 30, 40%.
Yeah.
So that's come from somewhere. You know, there's only so much money being spent on advertising, say, globally. You could see the trend as more and more got spent online. You could always see that the unit economics were better. You know, if you spend a dollar on Facebook advertising, you can see who clicks on it. You can measure your rate of return. It's like intrinsically better than just putting it out in print. You know, I think that was a trend that was like very kind of, you know, transparent and obvious. But the way I mentioned market indices is, let's say somebody disrupts Facebook and Google and takes those advertising dollars in some new way that we can't see yet.
Mm.
That'll actually be captured by the index.
Yeah.
Because that company will list, it'll be part of the NASDAQ. And as it grows, it will just become enormous and become a bigger and bigger weight in that index, whereas Facebook and Google will just shrink. You know, so the index always captures the innovator in a very interesting way that I think is unappreciated. And the other thing is indices don't trim their positions.
Yeah.
So if you come in at like number 500 on the S&P 500 and you grow, you know, 100x, the index is going to capture that. Whereas every manager, almost every manager that I can think of
will trim.
Yeah. And they'll never get that outcome. And they'll be wondering, bummer, I like underperformed. Well, it's because you didn't hold that with up.
But you're not saying that we should all just go buy indices.
I absolutely think there's a strong place for that in everybody's portfolio. I think the core, you know, my view is most people should have equities. They should have government bonds. I feel like credit's a bit kind of no man's land, but you could actually have that whole asset allocation argument.
Yeah.
But to me, credit's very similar to equity risk.
It's similar to equity risk. However, I think you need a very deep understanding of the credit market to really start playing in that space.
Yeah. And I feel like the best bit about government bonds, right, is they generally rally when everything goes wrong. Credit generally doesn't have that. So you think of the kind of risk curve, you know, super simplified. You've got government bonds, cash. So government bonds, then you've got credit, then you've got equity. So when things go risk off, money flows down from equity into credit and from credit into government bonds. And basically, the reason why I find credit is like very equity-like is it kind of trades like that. So when it's risk off, it kind of sells off. If you think about what happens like after that in those risk-off environments, typically the government then tries to reverse that flow. They want money flowing into risky assets, they want money flowing into investment to stimulate the economy. So they then start pushing money up into government bonds.
Yeah.
And so you've got this like two-way flow of like money coming out of equities and credit into government bonds, and then government's pushing on the other side to try and get it back. And that's why you can get some very explosive moves in the treasury market at the best possible times.
Mm. Makes a great case for bonds.
For government bonds. Yeah. That's why I think government bonds are a good part of an equity portfolio, whereas because equity returns are generally better, you know, I guess government bonds have a very good reason for being part of that portfolio. Otherwise, you just say hold equities for the long term. You know, if you're a long-term investor, you should just get the higher return.
Okay, then, Michael, so then where do you guys fit into that, in that situation?
Right. Well, we're an active manager and we'll always be a small part of people's portfolios. So I feel like our job is to actually look for those best opportunities, not to manage assets as though, you know, it's somebody's entire asset allocation. I can promise you it's my entire asset allocation.
Yeah.
But basically we need to find the best ideas, you know, and the best and sit on the long-term, you know, innovative trends, you know, that are driving the global economy. So you know, 10% of somebody's portfolio. I don't think we actually are anybody, 10% of anybody's portfolio, apart from, say, mine. If we see a really good idea, we actually should be taking a 5% position because that might be meaningful across their portfolio. And so let's say we take a 5% position and it goes great and it triples. If we don't trim, then that 15% position will add a lot of volatility to our portfolio. That's exactly what should be happening. I mean, that would be like, you know, 50 basis points of somebody's overall net wealth in that top portfolio idea that then becomes 1.5%. So across their portfolio, that extra volatility is almost meaningless.
Mm.
But we can actually move the needle if we get some of these companies that just grow for 10 years in a row. You know, that could make a meaningful difference to people's wealth.
Mm.
And that's broadly where we sit. You know, we're in that kind of like tiny part of your portfolio that you give to an active manager to find the best ideas. And also we look both ways. So we try and find structurally flawed industries to match those positions.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. And I mean, you're really building the case of why you should have you know, in a much broader portfolio. And I guess to lead on to that, like I am seeing a little bit of that thought process within that investor space lately. I've been having a chat to quite a number of institutional investors, and obviously with the volatility that happened late last year and a bit of volatility happening now with, you know, trade war negotiations, the yield curve moving, and, you know, God knows what's happening with the Fed rate. You know, they're confusing basically everyone these days. Downside protection has been a cause of, I guess, of action for them. And there's a few ways they can sort of go about it. I've seen some investors looking at getting a value manager, global sort of equities, an equity value manager in their portfolio. I've seen managers sort of try and do it themselves. So buying options or derivatives in order to sort of limit their downside exposure to equities. I've seen some investors looking at strategies, for example, convertibles, right? So convertible bonds, strategies, and also blending, obviously, equities and convertible bonds as well to sort of play around with the risk capture of their portfolio. And then obviously the long short funds. Now, I guess when I look at your strategy, you wouldn't say it's a fully true, I guess, high octane long short fund, because you do have that sort of hedged equities nature when markets are running, and use that via ETFs sometimes, use that via some stock specific shorts there as well. And that's interesting for investors because they can get that long-term view, that long-term equities exposure in the times when they need it. But obviously when markets are running, they do have the ability to feel a bit safer knowing that you do have sort of those the sort of macro hedges in place, so to speak, in order to limit that volatility. And there are times which you have shown in the past where you can actually generate some true alpha on your short positions. So that, I guess those sort of strategies are attractive in the market. I mean, if you can get it right, if you get it into that right sort of mix in a portfolio, you know, you can really get some inflows into a fund. In terms of where it would fit, I've seen some managers, some investors who may utilize your strategy more in that long only portfolio because of your exposures that you have. I mean, it's a pure alternative strategy, but it could have a case of being in an equities portfolio. I mean, why not? You could have a core manager in there. You could have a long only, a bit more of an alpha driven, you know, long equities manager in there, and then you can have a long short like yourself, where you can get that downside protection, and that makes a really good equities mix. It makes a really good equities mix in their portfolio. So, what you're saying is very correct. And obviously by using government bonds in there, that gives that extra little bit of tick or of kicker when markets are rallying, because you've got that downside protection. But as well, you can generate some good returns from those government bonds. So, I mean, yeah, that's, I guess, a little bit of what I'm saying in the market. Yeah.
Have you found people kind of pulled back a bit this year in terms of what they're willing to, you know, invest in? Or would you say everyone hasn't really made a difference?
I mean, look, at the end of the day, like, for example, look, I spoke to a pension or a superannuation fund last week, and they just said this: they are always looking for great strategies. Always. Mm-hmm. Like, whether the markets are up, whether the markets are down, they're always looking for great strategies, because the thing is, they have to allocate. They have to allocate. Like, they can't just sit in cash. So whether the market's up, whether the market's down, they're going to have to allocate. So I wouldn't say they're pulling back. You probably get more investors pulling back in sort of the ultra high net worth family office space. They have the luxury to, because their inflows aren't like a big superannuation fund who's getting, you know, $500 million in.
They can just move to cash, right?
They can.
Number one for most family offices.
That's right. Capital preservation, right? I mean, that is, you know, you hear it time and time again. Family officers say they're in the business of, they've already made their money, they're in the business of keeping their money. So obviously capital preservation is going to be key and essential for them. So yeah, they can move into cash. Well, not just cash, but they can move into instruments where the risk and volatility is a lot lower than obviously a higher.
So you're down the risk curve.
Big time down the risk curve. And I mean, family offices in Australia especially have made a lot of their property made a lot of their capital in property. So in markets like this, they could basically just risk off, right? They just sell out or move their capital into instruments like bonds or whatever it is in order to move down that risk curve. So they've got that luxury, but institutionally they have to allocate no matter what. You know, they've got all this inflow coming in every month. They can't just sit and do nothing. So I guess, yeah, to answer your question, no, they're not really pulling back. It's just, it's more of an asset allocation decision.
That's really interesting, Etty. So why don't we wrap it up there and we'll catch up again soon, I hope.
Yeah, definitely. I love being on the Fraser's Capital podcast.
I enjoyed it. Thanks again for coming on.
Absolute pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
And that was episode 9 of Fraser's Capital Podcast. If you enjoyed it and you want to learn more about us, our website is www.fraserscapitalpartners.com. I'm Michael Fraser's and I hope you have a great week.